Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 7th of April. This hour, the program Pakistan, and we have with us the author of the thorough piece in the New York Times Magazine cover story of April 5, just this past Sunday. It's titled Pakistan, Perilous, Anarchic, Broke, Violent, Splintering, Corrupt, Armed, Governable. James Traub is our guest, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, where he's worked since 1998. He was a staff writer also for The New Yorker, has written for the New York Review of Books, Foreign Affairs, and the Atlantic Monthly, and The New Republic, and has written extensively about international affairs and the UN. He's reported from Iran, Iraq, Sierra Leone, East Timor, Vietnam, India, Kosovo, Haiti, and Pakistan. He's the author of Best Intentions, Kofi Annan and the UN in the Era of American World Power. He's also author most recently of The Freedom Agenda. And he was in Pakistan meeting with the relatively new president of Pakistan just a couple weeks ago now. We're going to welcome phone calls for Jim. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And do you like to be called James or Jim?
Jim is fine.
Jim is fine. Hi, Jim. Thanks so much for being with us.
Delighted to be.
Well, let's talk about your first meeting with the relatively new president of Pakistan. You described this opening scene, and it says a lot about the whole scene in the country, how he approaches his office, what his office is like, and who was sitting there listening. How did he decide to grant an interview to you?
Well, you know, I can't give you the long answer because it takes too long. But the fact is, there was a faction around them that thought, this is a terrible idea. Don't talk to the foreign press. Don't talk to the New York Times. You'll regret it. Then there was a faction that said, no, no, here's your chance. You should talk to them. And people knew who I was. And so they thought, he's a high-minded fellow. He'll say what you said. He'll give you a chance.
Yeah.
So initially, he had agreed to talk to me at length, and I was going to spend a lot of time with him. But the faction around him, which opposed all this, managed to limit the whole thing to 1 hour. And I'm sure, having read the article, they feel like they were right and he shouldn't have talked to me at all.
Exactly. Do you think because he has an affinity for New York that he granted you the interview? You talk about the time that he spent in New York.
No. He granted the interview because a couple people whose judgment he trusted said that it would be, on balance, a good thing. No, he's been quite reluctant to talk to the foreign press. He has certain favorites in the Pakistani press who he can count on to report what he wants them to report. He talked to them. The foreign press he's much more cautious about.
You say that you met with him and he had just been through the most dangerous weeks of his 6 months in office. What were the dangers of those weeks, Jim?
Well, your listeners may have been reading during this period 3 weeks ago or so about this quite dramatic political situation where his opponents, both his political opponents and also the country's lawyers, had organized what they called a long march, which was designed to force him to do something he deeply did not want to do, which was to reinstate the country's former chief justice, whose name is Iftikhar Chowdhury, who had been deposed not by Zardari, but by the military dictator who preceded him, General Musharraf, and who plainly Zardari didn't want to return, probably for his own reasons. He may have feared that he himself would face some legal jeopardy. And so this drama then began by a very happy coincidence for me while I was there, complete coincidence. And Zardari grossly mishandled it. He tried to crush the whole thing. And, of course, that only made the movement much more powerful. It made him seem not like a democratic ruler, but like a tyrant. It made him seem fearful. And then in the end, he was forced to grant precisely the demands that he had said previously he would never grant.
Mm-hmm. And what could he be, if you dig into his past, what shady things could be there that could subject him to some legal maneuvers?
Well, Kathleen, the specific situation was this, that this guy had been accused over the years and indicted for a whole range of crimes, basically on corruption. And it is widely assumed in Pakistan that he was guilty at least of some of them. He was known as Mr. 10%. In the fall of 2007, when both he and his wife Benazir Bhutto, the former prime minister, were living abroad because they knew if they came back, they would be subjected to prosecution for these crimes. General Musharraf agreed, as part of a kind of package deal, to pass a rule called the National Reconciliation Order, which essentially absolved top officials of outstanding indictments, meaning you can come home now. And so Benazir Bhutto came back and was, of course, soon afterwards assassinated in a terrifying crowd scene in late 2007. This law is still on the books. I think one of Zardari's fears was that if this Chief Justice came back, he would examine this law, he would see it as unconstitutional, he would overturn it, and then Zardari and others as well would suddenly be once again be susceptible to criminal prosecution.
So tell me about the arrests that were taking place and the mood of the country. Was it close to really erupting into all-out violence?
I don't think so. I mean, it wasn't that. It was much more that. I mean, this was a political moment, not a military moment. It wasn't as if Pakistan, because of this drama, was on the brink of dissolution. I mean, I think the threats to Pakistan have much more to do with terrorism. But the threat certainly was to Zardari's own political future. I think the threat that lay behind that was that if the demonstrations begin to look really chaotic, the fear was that something which has happened in the past in Pakistan, the military steps in, would happen once again. And so I was there in the days before the demonstrations began, and the big fear was not a coup in the literal sense. It was much more that the military would bring all the political figures together and say, you guys are just being irresponsible and immature, and you're risking the future of the country, and this is what you have to do. Some kind of settlement, in effect, dictated by the military. And in the country, which has been struggling to free itself of decades of military rule and to really assert the supremacy of civilian rule, this would have been a terrible setback.
Yeah. You quote this key advisor to General David Petraeus, the CENTCOM commander, who says that within 1 to 6 months, David Kilcullen, his name is,
right,
we could see the collapse of the Pakistani state. And then you add, amid all that, the president appeared to be playing with fire.
First, I think he's probably a little too apocalyptic. 1 to 6 months strikes me as, it's hard to see the scenario whereby as quickly as that the government would dissolve. But it's not hard to see this in a somewhat longer term. There, we are not really talking only about these political events. We're talking about the relationship between the political events, which weaken the whole democratic structure, and national security issues. Because what's happening, clearly, is that the extremists who are located in the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan in these mountain fastnesses are moving further and further eastwards towards the main part of the country. And so the army has already surrendered an area called the Valley of Swat, which is 100 or so kilometers from the capital, Islamabad. And the fear is that will embolden the Taliban, that will say, you know what, if you kill enough people, then the army will withdraw, they'll reach some understanding with you, and then you're free to move further.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fear that people like Kilcullen are talking about is that ultimately the extremists, will in some way actually literally either unseat the government or produce utter chaos. I don't think the unseating thing, it's not easy to imagine literally a Taliban government in Pakistan. That's not an easy scenario to see. Much more a sense of growing chaos, fear, disorder.
Tell me more about the American attacks along the border. You say that they have been effective. I'm wondering how extensive they are, if they've changed their targets since the Obama administration came into power, and what the plans are for the current administration to conduct more of these attacks.
Yeah, Kathleen, this is probably the one aspect of policy that's changed the least. That is to say, I don't think there's an important difference between the way the Obama administration has used these predator drone attacks and the way the Bush administration did. Even Pakistanis who deeply oppose them will say they've gotten more and more effective One argument I heard is, you know, back when they started doing this last fall, they kept killing innocent civilians, they kept missing their targets, but that's not true anymore. Now, those people will say, yes, I concede they're effective. They've been killing al-Qaeda figures. They've been hitting the people the Americans want to hit. But they still shouldn't do it because it's bad for Pakistan. Because what it's doing, well, several things. One, it's driving these guys away from the border, which is what we want, but it's pushing them deeper into Pakistan, which is bad for Pakistan. Two, the terrorists are taking their revenge not on the Americans, who they can't take their revenge on, but on the Pakistanis. And so the terrorist attacks of just the last couple of days have been, the Taliban who mounted them have said, we're going to keep doing this so long as the Americans keep using the Predator strikes. So they are now, in effect, trying to blackmail the Americans by saying, we're going to keep killing Pakistanis until you stop doing this.
And what's Zardari doing about all of it?
Zardari is in an impossible position here. It's really an impossible position because the Pakistanis wanted to stand up to the Americans and say, you can't do this anymore. It's a violation of Pakistani sovereignty. I don't care how effective it is. But any Pakistani president has got to be able to find a way of working with the Americans. Now, clearly what Zardari has done is given a kind of silent assent to these Predator strikes, which, by the way, actually take off from Pakistani territory. That's where the drones are located, but in a quite remote area. I think the right answer, though, that we're going to have to get to at some point is that this has to be seen as a joint act in some way. Now, that does not mean the Pakistanis are going to have their hands on the joystick in Tampa, Florida, where CENTCOM is located, where the guys are actually controlling the drones. It does mean that I think there has to be a bigger Pakistani role in the overall decision-making process. Until this is seen as something which is done by Pakistan as well as by the United States, in the interest of Pakistan as well as the interest of the United States, you're going to have a profoundly disaffected Pakistani public. And that's really bad if we want to have genuine support from the Pakistani people, and also if we want to have an effective democratic government. Because otherwise, if the head of state is seen as an American stooge who's doing America's bidding, well, that's obviously going to discredit whoever that figure is.
And how disaffected is the Pakistani public right now, Jim?
Well, anti-Americanism, not in the sense of we hate the American people, but in the sense of American policy is bad and is a much bigger danger to us than the Taliban, is a kind of taken-for-granted point of view in Pakistan. And I think probably it's only a small elite which thinks otherwise. And so what clearly has not penetrated yet is extremism is a threat to us. People still want to think, no, this is America's preoccupation. They are making us dance to their tune. And if only they would leave, if they'd go away, things would be okay. And then we could focus again on our real enemy, which is India, which is how they tend to think. Now, I think the thing that we can't know yet is, what is the effect on the national psyche of this growing a surge in terrorist attacks perpetrated by Pakistanis against Pakistanis? Is that going to make people realize, no, this is our fight too? We're endangered by this. I don't know. The rationale people want is to say it'll all go away if the Americans stop doing this stuff.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Jim, and we'll take them in a moment. I hope many of you had a chance to see the New York Times Magazine cover story this past Sunday. It's on Pakistan, and Jim just returned from Pakistan. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and has done a great deal of work from a lot of hot spots in the world, Iraq and Iran and East Timor, Vietnam, India. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And we have lines open for you right now. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, today is the opening day of baseball for the Milwaukee Brewers, and we'll be talking about opening day all over the country and baseball in these difficult economic times, the role that it plays. What about the salaries that baseball players receive? Should those be a little lower considering these difficult economic times? We'll be speaking with Mike Baughman, who's a national columnist for MLB.com. And that's coming up the second hour of our program. If you'd like to join this hour as we discuss Pakistan, the number here is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And while we're getting phone calls answered, let me just ask Jim about the military in Pakistan for a moment. Why is it that the military has played such a prominent and some would say destructive role in Pakistan? What's the problem with building a strong, vibrant democracy, Jim?
I think, Kathleen, at root, it probably has something to do with the way that Pakistan came about as a country. You know, that it was all part of the same place until partition happened when the English left in 1947. And India was the bottom half, and Pakistan, in effect, became the top half. From its outset, Pakistan so identified itself as a kind of shelter from Indian aggression for the Muslims of South Asia that it really came to see itself as a kind of national security state. Why do we exist? We exist because we have to defend ourselves from India. This allowed, first of all, it allowed the kind of military bureaucratic apparatus to gain control in Pakistan. It also allowed them to defeat democratic aspirations, of which there were lots, because they would say, no, we can't afford that. And so some combination of Islam and military, defend ourselves from India, became the foundation stone of the country. And so whenever there was democratic government, as soon as there were problems, which inevitably there were, the military would move in and say, you see, these people are just so incompetent. We can't afford to have this. And then they would dissolve the government. There'd be some new government. Democratic government had great difficulty gaining traction in Pakistan and still does.
Let's go to phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join the conversation. And I guess you could send an email, too. That address would be talk at WPR.org, talk at WPR.org. Joining us this hour is the author of the really good piece in the New York Times, the Sunday magazine, and it's on Pakistan. Jim has just returned from Pakistan and writes about what's going on there now, extensive look at the new president of Pakistan and at what this new administration, our new administration, faces in terms of trying to keep the lid from blowing off. Let's go to Mike from Appleton, our first caller. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. I've got kind of like two questions that are kind of intermixed. I'll start with Pakistan.
All right, we have a bad phone line here, so if you can get really close to the phone, it's kind of...
I'm almost in the phone. Is that better?
Okay.
Okay.
There you go.
How safe are the Pakistan nukes? In other words, if that country is destabilized, how strong is the military to keep a lid on them? And are there factions in the military that might be more radical than we'd like? And what would happen if there was a major event in the region, like, for example, the Israelis taking out the Iranian nuclear facilities? You know, how does he see a scenario like that evolving?
Well, I first should say that this is an area where I don't have a whole lot of expertise, so I'm going to tell you, as well as I can understand it, which is, The positive part is that I think that Pakistan's nuclear command, as I understand it, is actually quite serious. It's a very well-constructed thing. I don't think that Americans worry that nuclear materials are going to go, nuclear missiles could be readily smuggled out of the country, that kind of thing. And I think absent this kind of not quite imaginable scenario of a Taliban takeover of the country, that's not the immediate threat. However, the second part of your question, which is how reliable is the military itself? How divided are they? Are there elements that are sympathetic to the Taliban? And the answer is yes. That's a real concern. Now, is that a concern in terms of nuclear safety? I don't know the answer to that question. I don't think so, but I don't have the confidence to say it's not. I think the greater danger is that how can a military prosecute this war on terror if large parts of the military and of the intelligence apparatus basically think the guys we're fighting against are us. The guys we're fighting for are the Americans, them. And that means that they're going to be fighting in a very half-hearted way. Until the military really takes on board that this is their fight, and these guys are threatening their country, then we can teach them all the counterinsurgency tactics we want. It's still going to be a half-hearted battle.
So how does that happen?
Why is there that mentality?
No, how do you get them to change, to think it's their fight?
That we cannot do. Oh. That they can only do for themselves. We can teach them the counterinsurgency tactics, but there has to be a change in the national climate of belief. And this is where the president of the country or the prime minister of the country really matters a lot. That is to say, I think a failure of Zardari's. Well, let me distinguish in two things. Zardari's actual professed views on the need to battle terrorism are right. He very much would like the military to stop its preoccupation with India. He very much would like to settle the ongoing problem with India, which originates with a dispute over this area called Kashmir between them. He is quite rational in all those things, and that's good. The bad thing is this. The answer to your question, Kathleen, is the political class needs to be able to speak clearly to people and say, this is our fight, too. So you need someone who has the legitimacy to say that, who has the ability to speak in public, to articulate these views, and to bring people along with him. That Zardari has not been able to do. And all of this endless political infighting makes it that much harder for either Zardari or any other such person to be able to speak clearly and strongly to a very, very skeptical and nervous public.
So it's not necessarily the emergence of a strong, charismatic, smart leader who will lead Pakistan to a different place.
I wish there were such a person. There isn't any such a person on the horizon right now. If Zardari's government falls in normal parliamentary maneuvering to its opposition, which is LN, you would then get the leader of the PMLN, who's a man named Nawaz Sharif, who might be better than Zardari. I don't know, but I don't think that he would make a radical difference.
Right. Did that answer your question, Mike?
Can I kind of ask like a follow-on?
Of course.
Well, okay, I understand what your guest says makes sense. In other words, nobody really knows.
No, I don't really know.
I don't think anybody does. But what about a major event in the area? Let's assume that the Israelis use their aircraft or use their rockets and take out the Iranian nuclear facilities and you know that area starts to really, you know, heat up and boil up. I mean, how does that affect Pakistan, India? I can see some major shifts in the area as people start to jockey for position.
Well, okay, but if you think in the literal strategic sense, what's going to happen? I mean, I think the threat there does not lie from the side of South Asia. The threat in terms of a response to Israel's action lies from elsewhere in the Gulf and the Middle East. I mean, what would happen in Pakistan is people would be outraged, they would take to the streets, they would be furious at Zardari because he isn't denouncing Israel and the United States in loud enough terms, kind of as what happens in Egypt with Mubarak, who's seen as far too soft on these matters. That would not lead Pakistan to do anything. Pakistan is not suddenly going to deliver nuclear weapons to terrorists in order to take revenge on Israel. That's not in the interest. The military, whatever their views are, is highly rational and pragmatic in that regard. So I wouldn't worry about that scenario. I'd worry about lots of things happening in the Middle East if Israel does that.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks.
Let's go to Syed from Milwaukee. Hello.
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 Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Question for Jim, and also in support of Jim, what he's saying. I am just back from Pakistan, staying 5 months in Lahore, and my observation is exactly what he's saying. I think we need to do is... As American, we need to support Pakistani government, civilian government, try to help them to control the Islamists or people who are really on the extreme and against American. They are developing situation over there against American people right now. We need to take America out of there, give the support to Pakistani government, tell them to help stop this extremism from Afghanistan. And I think we will be much better off as American nation than what we are doing now.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the reasons, and there are lots of reasons why the United States is unpopular in Pakistan, is that we supported General Musharraf right to the end. Now, Musharraf was not so terribly unpopular for a number of years, but starting in early 2007, when he fired this Chief Justice, and then a whole series of other events came after that, he became instantly the villain of the Pakistani political drama. And the widespread belief, which was not wrong, was that what propped him up in power was American support. And for all the Bush administration's fine language about democracy promotion, here was a case where you had a kind of mass uprising in defense of constitutional principles against a military dictator, and we took the side of the military dictator. So it is really important now that the United States not only be, but be seen as supporting democracy in Pakistan. That does not mean supporting Asif Ali Zardari, though, of course, he's the head of state. We will continue to support him. It means supporting democracy, and that's why the role that Hillary Clinton, our special envoy Richard Holbrooke, our ambassador, and others played during this political drama, where they were trying to intercede with Zardari to make him stop, to basically climb down from his confrontational tactics, was a good thing. However, such is the hostility against the United States that I doubt we got much credit for it. But it certainly is important for us to be seen trying to help Pakistan's civilian institutions and not just its military.
Yes. Yes. Can I have a follow-up question?
Yes. Yes.
About Zardari himself, I mean, personally, I know some events which had happened there while I was there, such as this independent power producer, people who were trying to help them produce the power and electricity to provide to the public over there. They invested billions of dollars in there to, of course, have their a successful business. Zardari had some of those people who had the WAPDA, which was the controlling power of this Pakistani electricity producer. Now, any individual producer produced the electricity, sell it to WAPDA, which is water and some, I don't
water
know
and power.
What it comes down to.
Yeah, water and power, right.
Yeah, and that institution was not paying them back for anything. Zardari went to those people because they were helpless or through his means and he bought those independent outfits.
Yeah, you know, you hear all sorts of stories about how Zardari and the people around him are using their political power to enrich themselves. Now, they're plausible, given past history. I don't know how much they're true, but you hear, for example, that Zardari's friends in Karachi, which is the southern port city where he is from, have been in some way shaking people down or something. You hear stories about properties that Zardari is said to have his eye on, that he is putting the squeeze on people to give to him. The belief, the Pakistani people believe these stories. They're rampant. They are part of Zardari's own identity. And so you can easily see why this leads to deep cynicism about his role in Pakistan.
Well, you write about the properties he bought. Wasn't it in England? That was some time ago, though, right?
Right, but this is even worse in a way. It's that, okay, fine, he stole this money, he made all this dough, he bought property. No, this is, for example, one of the stories you hear constantly is that one of the most beautiful properties in Islamabad is a lovely hilltop area, which is owned by the family that owns the Marriott Hotel, the second biggest hotel in Islamabad, in fact, the one that was famously bombed last year, and that Zardari has been trying to get a hold of this property. The family is said to have fled, I believe, to Dubai because it is said that they fear for their future. And so, you know, this is just kind of the daily material of the Islamabad political discourse. And so people are willing to believe anything bad about Zardari. Whether or not it is so is another question.
Right. Well, maybe he needs to do a little bit more to help people who don't have very much. What do you think?
That would help. I think he probably needs to do a little bit less to enrich himself.
Right. Tell me about how he met Benadir Bhutto and their marriage. He had his eyes on her for a long time.
Yeah, in Pakistan, this is a favorite, or used to be a favorite, subject for speculation, because Benazir Bhutto comes from one of the great families of Pakistan. Her father, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, was the prime minister of Pakistan in the 1970s, and a terribly dashing and glamorous figure who had gone to Cambridge, and the family was enormously wealthy. And so here Benazir is dazzlingly beautiful, immensely wealthy, glamorous, powerful, everything, the most desirable woman in Pakistan. Now, Asif Ali Zardari comes from a similar class in the sense that he's from the same region that she's from. They're both Shia in a country that's about 80% Sunni Muslim, but they were very modest-scale landowners, not a particularly progressive family, and a little raffish. The father owned a movie theater in Karachi, the Bambina. So, and he, Asif Ali Zardari, was considered a polo-playing playboy and a thoroughly uneducated person, a kind of charming, roustabout character. And so it's not hard to see why he would set his eyes on Benazir. It's not easy to see why she would have said yes to him. But the fact is, by this time, she was no longer young. This happened in the mid-1980s, so she was already about 32 or so. She needed to be married to somebody if she was going to be prime minister of the country. He had the right surface characteristics, and he's a very charming, gracious, gallant fellow. And so she finally said yes.
And they got along okay?
That's a little beyond my ken. I mean, I would say, and here I'm just going to repeat what is a kind of widespread view, since I never even met Benazir. She was quite smitten with him, so it is said. But it also became clear quite early on that he was a real problem, because his wheelings and dealings became immediately a matter of widespread speculation. She never let him actually have a constituency and stand for office as a party member. Whatever private role he had, he was never given a public role. The two times that her government was dismissed, it was dismissed in both cases on charges of corruption. The corruption in both cases alleged was his, and perhaps also hers as well. It is certainly widely said that by the time he emerged from his second stint in prison in 2004, when he moved to New York while she was living in Dubai, that at that point they were mostly married in name only.
I see. These stories just keep coming, don't they, Jim?
Indeed.
Oh, yeah. Let's welcome more phone calls. Here's our number if you'd like to join this conversation. Our guest is the author of the New York Times Magazine cover story of a couple days ago, Pakistan, Perilous, Anarchic, Broke, Violent, Splintering, Corrupt, Armed, Governable. James is the author of this piece and actually just returned very recently from Islamabad, where he arrived on March 10, and just quite by chance, the long march was set to begin in a couple days. So he writes about what that was all about and what are the feelings concerning democracy, which he says feels as flimsy as a wooden shack. Pakistan feels as if it's falling apart. And, of course, how dangerous this country may be. So we're talking about all of these issues this hour. Join us if you'd like. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. for you to be a part of our conversation. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of the program, baseball has begun its season, the 2009 season, and we'll be talking about the opening day for the Milwaukee Brewers and baseball games being played all over the place. So that's coming up. Hour number two of our show, Pakistan This Hour. Phone lines are open if you'd like to join the conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. And Jim Traub is our guest, 800-486-8655. President Obama said, and you quote him in your article, "For the American people, this border region, Pakistan, Afghanistan, has become the most dangerous place in the world." Would you describe it as such, Jim?
Oh, no question. Mm. I mean, this is... terrorists require a sanctuary in which to operate, especially given modern American weaponry, where they can so easily be blasted to smithereens otherwise. In that sense alone, the Pakistan-Afghanistan border is a much likelier place for terrorists to gather, at least in terms of having international ambitions, than Iraq, which is a desert where people can very easily be seen and hit. It's extremely difficult in that border area. And so right now, I think anybody would say that this is the area where the training goes on for people who then are sent out elsewhere. This is the area which poses the greatest threat to the future of Afghanistan. And now it is the area which poses the threat of destabilizing Pakistan, a country with 170 million people and a nuclear arsenal. So I think it's an easy call.
What's attractive to some of the Pakistani people about the Taliban?
Well, I think the honest answer, while there are some who have maybe a similar medieval view of that the Taliban do, I don't think that's true of most. I think it's much more, and you see this everywhere in the world, when you have deeply failed governance, as you do in Pakistan, where people really are profoundly cynical about the ability of the political system to just deliver the basics of a good life to them, which is to say the possibility of some kind of progress in their life, economic progress, schools, public health, day-to-day acts of justice, things like that. When people give up on that, then it creates a space that someone else can move into who promises to offer such things. And so the example that's often given is, why do so many Pakistanis, impoverished Pakistanis, send their children to madrasas, to these very, very religious schools? Well, the answer is because they don't have a decent public school system to go to instead. Why is it that in this area I mentioned earlier, the Valley of Swat, which is a kind of honeymoon area for Pakistan, a beautiful alpine-like area. How is it that people in that area, who are conservative but in no sense theologically fundamentalist, have now welcomed in the Taliban, which is now providing their own form of rough justice? Well, the answer is because the same governing failures that existed elsewhere in Pakistan existed there, but here there was the Taliban to offer an alternative. People don't like that alternative, but it is something, and so they have embraced it. And the only way to defeat that, and in some ways you might say the easy answer to defeating it, is provide a better alternative.
Yes. We go next to Peter from Elm Grove. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. How are you?
All right. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good.
I have a question about Pakistan's nuclear program. There's a scientist named Abdul Qadir Khan who was basically the driving force behind Pakistan's nuclear program and stole the secrets of uranium enrichment from Britain and basically spearheaded Pakistan's program. And he was eventually put under house arrest and was just released recently. And I was wondering what the political motivation for that was and what that means in terms of Pakistan being a nuclear power, especially since this was the main person who had been distributing these secrets not only to Iran but also to North Korea.
Yeah, I think the answer is it's nothing but bad. And so the political fact behind this decision to release him is that there was no groundswell of opinion in Pakistan that this was a bad guy. People thought he's the father of our nuclear program. And I must say, to me personally, I find it kind of sad that this national scientific hero who was raised to this level was, as you rightly say, he was a thief. He was not a great scientist. He stole the plans. And yet he has this status as the father of Pakistan's nuclear program. And so people viewed the house arrest as being nothing more than buckling to the Americans. Now he has been released. And so clearly the guy has the contacts he has before. He has the knowledge he has before. He's a dangerous guy. I think even beyond the danger that he individually poses is the mindset which has made it necessary to release him. Not just popular mindset, but clearly also in the military and the intelligence apparatus. The nuclear system in Pakistan is almost entirely under military control. In theory, there is joint civilian control, but not in fact. And so this is something where if the mentality inside the military and the intelligence is Pakistan needs to have its nuclear capacity, it needs to keep it secret, it needs to be able to use it as it sees fit, including selling secrets to others, including giving special help to our Islamist brethren, well, that's a really dangerous mindset to have to deal with.
Mm. Peter, anything else?
No, well, I mean, I think it's also just, you know, I think it goes to show that we have absolutely no political clout there because we can't even keep this dangerous scientist under wraps. And you know, the situation's deteriorating even further. And the problem is also that several things in Pakistan operate completely independently from each other. The prime minister had no idea what was going on with Khan, and Khan had no idea what was going on with the military, and nobody's in control of anything. And they sort of basically work independently of each other.
Yeah, I would agree with part of that and not agree with all of it. I mean, the United States actually has a remarkable amount of influence in Pakistan. That's why E.Q. Khan was detained in the first place. It's why the Predator drone strikes continue. And so the fact is there are things that we have been able to get leadership in Pakistan to do that they would never do otherwise. But there are sharp limits on that influence, and the release of A.Q. Khan goes to that. The second point, which is that you have these different centers of power, is absolutely right. And it's very hard to know what the phone number is you want to call when you're calling Pakistan, because you have a president who is supposed to be subordinate to the prime minister, but he's not. The prime minister is subordinate to him. And then you have what is supposed to be a system of civilian supremacy, but it's not. On all important national security issues, it is basically civilian governments imploring the military to act in a certain way. And then within the military, you have this intelligence apparatus, which is in some ways autonomous, controlled by the military, but maybe at lower levels full of people who are freelancing.
Oh, my gosh.
Overall, just a scary situation.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for
it
your
is.
Comment.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Can we go back to those drones for just a moment? When
yes.
I want you to talk more when you said, because I found it intriguing, that some of those strikes had been, while effective, you talk about them, they've also created some problems. How have they been effective? What's resulted that's
they
good?
They killed the guys they're supposed to kill.
Okay.
So what's happening is you have the al-Qaeda commanders, who are, well, the al-Qaeda troops, who are fighting in Afghanistan, and their goal is to overthrow the government in Afghanistan, well, they need a place to hide. And so what they've been able to do is scurry onto the other side of the border. And you have to imagine this is just a wild mountainous area, and the border means essentially nothing. But it was kind of ollie, 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 ump and free. You know, I'm now home free. I'm on the other side of the border. The American troops can't chase me. And indeed, we have said we will not engage in hot pursuit on the other side of the border. But if we don't do anything, and if we regard that border as sacrosanct, then we will allow these guys to gather there and to organize and to launch devastating attacks across the border in Afghanistan. And so the purpose of these drone attacks is to end that sense of impunity, to go after these guys, to push them out of the way, and to deter them. And that has worked in a lot of ways, though, again, it's limited. You're not actually seriously eliminating the threat. You're trying to target individual commanders. And second, there is this other problem that these guys then move deeper into Pakistani territory.
But we've been at this so long. Why is it taking so long?
Well, I would say because it is an inherently difficult problem. With many, many, many elements. So you have failed government in Afghanistan. Afghanistan, which increases, which makes it harder to fight the Taliban, because the Taliban there too fill a vacuum. You have this deep ambivalence on the part of the Pakistanis, which makes it harder for them to effectively attack the terrorists. You have a military in Pakistan which is totally configured for conventional warfare against a rival state, India, which is now very, very slowly adapting counterinsurgency tactics. And it is worth adding that it took our military a long time to realize in Iraq that it had to start acting according to counterinsurgency principles as opposed to much more conventional military principles. So you have all these things happening. You have an extremely determined adversary, and you have geography really against you. I mean, you cannot overlook the sheer fact of geography. These are incredibly remote areas which are great places to hide.
Right. And the Pakistani military has learned counterinsurgency. Is it Johnny-come-lately to this? They've learned it by themselves, or we've helped train them?
No, there's been a lot of American training. I mean, one of the sort of terrible wastes of recent years is that we gave $10 billion to the Pakistani military, and the idea was two-thirds of it is said to have gone as reimbursement for their own expenditures in carrying out the war on terror, but it's not at all clear what happened to that money. And it seems to have been remarkably unsupervised, and there certainly was no systematic attempt to produce a force that could really stand up to the Taliban. So right now, Pakistan pits its military occasionally, and more often what's called the Frontier Corps, which consists of guys who are from that region, Pashtuns, which is the ethnic group in these tribal areas, who therefore know the area, know the people, and so on, but they've been woefully underfunded until now, and they've really been incapable of taking the fight to the Taliban. So a lot of precious time was wasted, I think, in recent years when there was no concerted attempt to do this.
We really have a problem giving away a lot of money with very little oversight on so many fronts, don't we, Jim?
Yeah, and this one I think was particularly inexcusable, and it makes the whole thing look like it was a gigantic bribe to Musharraf to be on our side. But he wasn't really on our side. He was on both sides.
Yeah, it sounds like that's true of other people there. And what about Musharraf and the military? Tell me we talked a little bit about this earlier. Do people fear there may be another military coup? Is there a strong leader now of the military?
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting question. I don't think people fear a coup right now. They do fear that the military will continue to dominate this political space. The guy who is the Army Chief of Staff, whose name is Ashfaq Kayani, is a widely admired guy, especially in the West. I mean, he made a big, big impression when he came to Washington a couple months ago. And he's widely considered to be, and this is certainly the impression I got from talking to military people in Pakistan, a thoughtful guy, a cautious guy, a guy who does not have political ambitions, a genuinely patriotic guy. So that obviously is all really good and encouraging. But there's this, the more the political class seems unable to meet these challenges, the greater is the tendency for the military to just fill that space. Mm-hmm. And that's a really pernicious tendency because the civilian politics has to be allowed to make mistakes. You know, as even Zardari said to me, you know, a child only learns how to walk by being allowed to fall down. Now, God knows they've fallen down a lot, but they haven't really had a chance to kind of learn from their mistakes. And so you do not want to have the military saying, you guys cannot handle it. We're going to assert ourselves again. That's not healthy.
So were you happy to get home? Did you feel like this was a bit much? Did you feel as though it was dangerous?
Islamabad, which is where I was. I was kind of confined, alas, to Islamabad because I kept waiting for Zardari to agree to talk to me. That was really discouraging because all the exciting stuff, this big demonstration, was happening actually in the place that the Pakistani gentleman mentioned, Lahore, which is several hundred miles away. And that's where I would have been if I could have. So Islamabad, which is the capital, is basically a kind of gigantic modern city of broad boulevards and big houses and nice lawns and roundabouts and parks and so on. It's a perfectly pleasant place. It is in no sense whatsoever frightening. I mean, occasional terrible things happen, but your day-to-day experience there is quite a pleasant and calm. It's just kind of boring, frankly.
But the story isn't boring.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Jim, thank you so much for being with us and for the article. It's great insight for us and something we need to keep track of, don't we?
I guess so. Well, thanks very much, Kathleen.
Yeah, our pleasure. Thank you. Jim Traub, our guest this hour, his piece is in the New York Times just this past Sunday. It's the cover story, Pakistan Perilous, Anarchic, Broke, Violent, Splintering, Corrupt, Armed, Governable. And he has been a writer for the New York Times Magazine for a number of years, also was a staff writer for the New Yorker. He's the author of several books, most recently The Freedom Agenda. Also, he's the author of Kofi Annan and the UN in the Era of American World Power, and The Devil's Playground, A Century of Pleasure and Profit in Times Square, and also the author of several other books. He's also, we didn't talk about this, policy director of the Global Center for the Responsibility to Protect. So you can find the article online at the New York Times, or you can look at your Sunday New York Times Magazine and find this really interesting article. He just happened to, life is timeliness, isn't it? He happened to arrive in Islamabad on March 10, and that long march was set to begin in just 2 days. So he writes quite a bit about that. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing the hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thank you, everybody, for your calls. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we'll have some fun as we talk about baseball. Opening day for the Milwaukee Brewers is today. This is the Ideas Network.